Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost. Stand alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is consumer affairs expert Grace Gorsden. And coming up, as we take the final tentative steps out of lockdown, expect plenty of disruption ahead for travellers. You can still bag a bargain on flights if you fancy it, but watch out as you could be hit in the pocket elsewhere. Car hire, it's on the rise. As is inflation. Rubbish for savers, but how long is the situation going to last? Simon gives us an economics 101 using a bag of old crisps. Grace is back on the case. This time it's a massive Dartford Crossing bill and a reader question about gifting homes and inheritance tax. Don't forget you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, finally, you can travel abroad. The restrictions have been eased, the flights booked, the apps downloaded, the tests taken, masks at the ready. My God, this is really happening. The flight lands, you are standing at the car hire desk, the kids are screaming, but never mind, you can almost taste the foreign sun gleaming off the tarmac outside. And then, wham, you're hit with a massive car hire bill, three times higher than normal. And Simon, this isn't just a one-off issue, is it? Did you like my build-up there? I was trying to get a sense of being away, you know, you've... Yeah,
the sense of drama that built throughout that introduction was almost unbelievable.
Thanks.
I think it was possibly akin to the feeling you get in a penalty shootout that we're not going to talk about.
Yeah, but the disappointment.
One thing I would say is, if you've gone to all that effort to manage to get abroad, don't go get your car sorted only at the car hire desk. Mm. Ideally, you have booked this car before you've got there. And in fact, you've compared the prices to find the one that's got the best deal rather than just going to any old car hire firm, which most of which still don't operate on the offer the customer who comes direct to you the best price. So you want to be going to like Car Rentals or Holiday Autos or something like that, your preferred search engine of choice. But obviously that doesn't help with the drama that you were just building up there.
Yeah.
So you will have already known before you go away that the price is going to be really expensive. In fact, actually, unfortunately, though, you may have only just found that out this week when you read our story, because I must admit, I didn't realise this until this week. And it was only when this story emerged of one of our readers, gentleman, Mr. Hull, planning to travel to Italy, some cheap flights off to Naples, usual cost of car hire there, not very expensive, discovered it was going to be almost four times as expensive as normal and going to cost him £750 for a small car for 2 weeks.
Wow. And the flight was £35, if I'm correct. £35, wow. That's...
Yeah, exactly. And he said, once you added the cost of all the tests to the car hire, even though the flights were only £35, it was so exorbitantly expensive that they just couldn't justify going anymore and they just decided to go another time. Now, I will admit that I played a part in this story, because when this cropped up, I went looking through and I checked what the cost of car hire would be for the final week of August in Portugal, exact same week that I went last year. And same week, same car hire company. Okay. So absolutely the same. Last year, I paid £107 for a little city car for the 6 days. We weren't quite there for 7 days. And bear in mind, I booked that pretty much, I think it was either the day before or 2 days before. This year, the price of that exact same car, or similar, as they do at the car hire desks, £301. So nearly three times as expensive. And this is a situation that's playing itself out all over Europe, all over the world. And amazingly, there was a great story in the Economist last week about U-Haul trucks on the beach in Hawaii. And in America, this is a problem. And obviously, they've had a bit more freedom to travel around in America for longer than we have. It's difficult to get there and it's difficult to leave. But the Americans can actually travel around their own country. And they do a lot of driving to do that, or they fly somewhere and they do a lot of driving. They've got a massive shortage of car hires, and they've started hiring those U-Haul trucks. You know, like if you were going to hire a van to move some stuff, self-hire a van, that people are finding that that's cheaper than trying to hire a car. So they're going on holiday to places like Hawaii and hiring themselves essentially a truck, but you know, for not one of their utility trucks they like to drive around with that are basically as comfortable as a mainstream car, but an actual van.
So this isn't a fact of car companies just hiking prices because they can. This is something actually more fundamental, isn't it?
this is something more fundamental. There's a shortage of cars. There's a shortage of new cars. They've got a shortage of cars to hire. And when you have a shortage of some of supply of something and you have lots of demand, the prices go up. And there's a number of factors coming into play here. One of which is the semiconductor shortage, which is computer chips that go into cars. There's a massive global shortage of computer chips because there's a supply and demand issue. There's been a lack of supply due to COVID, factories shutting down, not being able to ramp up quickly enough, and also an increase in demand because with every day that passes, more stuff is made that requires a computer chip to go into it. So if you just take cars, for example, electric cars using lots of chips, all of the infotainment stuff, the sensors, everything in your car is basically done by computer now. And they can't make these chips fast enough. The car companies can't get their hands on them. Some of the car companies have had to slow down production. Jaguar Land Rover did, for example, in this country. And what it means is that the car hire companies, which rely on only owning cars for about a year or two maximum, and often closer to a year, and then they turn them over and they buy some new ones in, are struggling to buy in new cars. And they actually, I mean, they have it built into their system that they have to sell the existing cars. Now, what they could do is they could decide to hold on to the existing cars, except they flogged a load of them. Because one of the businesses that was unsurprisingly very hard hit by most of the major Western economies in the world, and many of those in the East, ordering people to stay at home for substantial point times of the last year, was car hire. And they struggled to survive, and so they flogged off some of their fleet in order to get some money in, presumably working on the basis that they'd be able to buy cars back when they needed them. They tend to buy in bulk, they tend to buy on discount, and now they can't get enough cars. And what this is feeding through to is obviously higher prices for holiday makers, consumers, etc. The car companies are reluctant to sell the cars to the car hire companies over the consumers. So they're prioritizing consumers because consumers tend to pay closer to full price, whereas the car hire companies order in bulk. And another issue is the erratic demand, particularly in Europe, where as rules change, and as we know, rules can change quite dramatically on where you can and can't go on holiday, all of a sudden they're seeing massive spikes in demand of people going, I need a hire car for this week, I can suddenly go to the Balearics. And then, oh no, I can't go to the Balearic Islands anymore. I don't need my car hire. And a lot of hire cars, especially if you go through the comparison sites, you have free cancellation right up until the very last minute. So people are just dumping the cars. And then all of a sudden, you would have had a scenario where a week ago, looking 3 weeks ahead, you would have probably had a shortage of cars to hire in Ibiza and Mallorca, right? Because everybody's trying to go to Ibiza and Mallorca because they're on the green list. All of a sudden, they're back on the amber list. People are going, oh, I can't go to Ibiza and Mallorca anymore. And people are just cancelling their bookings. So now they're probably going to end up with too many cars there. But where are people going to try to go to now? Oh, well, maybe they're going to try to go to another destination. But that other destination might be very difficult for one of the car hire companies to get a car to from Ibiza or Mallorca. It's holiday roulette.
Isn't it just? And I think it's going to be for some time. Grace, consumer affairs expert, what can you do to protect yourself in this situation? Is there anything?
Well, the recommendation is to, if you're going to rent a car, not leave it until the last minute, because as Simon says, you can, in often many cases, get free cancellation, such as you can through booking.com and other sites for holidays. It's a really common thing to do now. So the sooner you book in advance, you're probably going to get a better deal and you can cancel for free, most likely. It's also worth, as Simon said again, to research all your options, look in advance, use comparison sites, see what's out there. Don't just look on one site that you might always use. Use other sites and compare, see if you can get a better deal. I think as well, one thing that's worth noting is that pickup and drop-off locations can have an impact on price. So if you can be flexible with where you're picking up and dropping off your car, it may be the one that's slightly further from the airport, you might be able to save a bit of money as opposed to one that's right there. So they're all things that are worth considering.
It just seems another roadblock, as it were, in the what used to be so simple of just going away on holiday for a week in Spain, for example. Talking of weeks in Spain and holidays and all that sort of thing, Grace, there's been lots of speculation I don't know how much this is true. Lots of people obviously looking at flights, looking at holidays. I assume more people are booking because, let's be honest, it was a pretty low base before. Don't get caught up in the hype, though, people, if booking companies and airlines are saying that tickets are selling out, you know. But it doesn't quite seem to be, Grace, I could be wrong, impacting massively on the cost of things like flights. Is that fair, or is it? It just depends on where you're going.
No, I think it's fair to say that costs for flights and package holidays are lower than I think most people would expect. Skyscanner, as of this week, have still got flights as low as £15 to places such as Turin and Barcelona, which are both going to be on amber list countries as of Monday. So you would think that prices, as soon as the announcement was made, would go straight up, but actually they're remaining quite low. The reason for that being is possibly the high cost of everything else going on holiday, as we've mentioned. So car hire, the PCR tests are incredibly high, hundreds of pounds. Accommodation as well is relatively cheap as per the package holidays, but travel providers are really trying to keep costs down where they can to encourage those who haven't booked holidays yet to do so. If these prices went up to the usual that we would expect, perhaps, you know, a few hundred as opposed to, say, 146 for 7 nights to Lanzarote 3-star, which is incredibly good value, people wouldn't do it because by the time you add on the PCR test, the uncertainty, the insurance, you're looking possibly for a family of four, maybe well over £1,000. So by keeping flights low and package holiday prices low, they're hoping this will encourage people who maybe are a little bit on the fence about whether to travel to say, actually, it's £15. If you book it and if you can't go, you're only losing £15.
Yeah, I did that with a £5 flight. I never went. It was the 28th of June. And I thought, well, it's only a fiver. And I suppose if everyone thinks, well, it's only a fiver, that's a relatively nice little earner to the airline company. But anyway, flight inflation looks to be pretty stable at the moment, but that is not the case, generally speaking. Inflation we got this week is up to 2.5%. Rubbish for savers. We'll get onto that in a minute. But it is something that we talk about a lot. I mean, obviously, we're personal finance journalists, so we are going to talk about a lot. But I mean, generally, people talk about the rising costs of living. But sometimes all it takes, Simon, is a packet of crisps for it to really hit home. Firstly, Simon, what's going on with inflation at the minute?
The inflation, official inflation figure, CPI inflation, is up to 2.5%. Mm-hmm. It was revealed this week by the ONS. That's up from 2.1% on the most recent reading and is higher than it was thought it was going to be. It's not running as high as it is in the US, where there's a major concern over inflation. But there are lots of questions asked over the inflation figure and whether that genuinely represents what people are paying for things. It is being distorted by coming off a low base, so it's measured as compared to a year ago. And as compared to a year ago, we're looking at things that were substantially cheaper due to initial lockdown pandemic reasons, i.e. petrol. It's up from something like £1.06 a litre to £1.30 a litre. That's a big jump. Energy prices are rising. Some of the other stuff that goes into the basket that people just weren't buying or couldn't really buy are going up. The concern is that it keeps going higher and then doesn't go lower, that it sticks higher. Now, the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve in the US have both said it's transitory, it's a spike, it'll go back down. It's being caused by the distortion of comparing it to a year ago and the troubles with supply and demand, the perfect storm that we've spoken about before. I mean, even, you know, like the example of the semiconductors that we were just talking about, the chip shortage, but also things like the Suez Canal, lots of stuff being stuck and not being able to get through there, and still supply issues to do with that, shipping costs going up and so on. So that's where we stand with inflation now.
Your old bag of crisps, Simon. Do you actually literally have a bag of crisps from the 80s?
No. I don't have a heritage bag.
I don't know why
crisps.
I had it in my head. That I think it's because I was doing some research for this story, and there was a story about a man who'd found a Mars bar stuck in his loft since 1986. Can't imagine what that was like once you found it about 30 years later. But so you don't actually have a bag of crisps from the 80s?
No, okay. I don't have a bag of crisps from the 80s. I don't tend to hold on to them for that long. I tend to eat them, if I'm going to be entirely honest. What's with the bag of crisps?
Yeah.
Right. Everybody, I think, has something that they buy that whenever they buy it, despite regularly purchasing it, they think, how did it get to being that expensive? I always think of it being cheaper. For me, it's a bag of crisps, just an ordinary sized bag of crisps. Mm. I don't want to go into the madness of grab bags here.
No.
Which is like the opposite of shrinkflation being pushed onto a public that really don't need to eat a bag and a half of crisps. The normal, ordinary size bag of crisps, i.e. just a bag of Walkers. Other brands are available, but my preference would be for a salt and vinegar, or if I'm feeling really lucky and I can find one in the shop, a bag of smoky bacon. Mm. Now, these inevitably cost me about 80p nowadays. Mm. Yet in my mind, a bag of crisps still costs 40p. So what's going on there? Well, somehow I've anchored on this price of a bag of crisps, and the price of a bag of crisps has gone up steadily but consistently and slowly over the years to the point where it's now 80p. It's now twice as much as I think it should be. Where's this 40p price come from? I reckon it comes from my early 20s, 20 years ago. Okay, so we're actually talking early 2000s. We're not talking the 1980s here. Talking early 2000s, the era when my metabolism would allow me to buy three bags of crisps and eat them all in one go. The good old days. And I had a bit of money. I was starting to work. I had some money. I could afford to splash out on a couple of bags of crisps and go completely crazy. But over the years, the price has steadily gone up. So what does it take to get from 40p to 80p over 20 years? 3.5%. 3.5% a year on average. Now, 3.5% doesn't sound like a lot, in the same way that 2.5% doesn't sound like a lot. It's like, okay, inflation's 2.5%. That's fine. I could probably cope with that. Stuff going up by 2.5%. What? It's going to cost me an extra, something that costs a pound is going to cost me an extra 2.5p next year. I can handle that. I can handle an extra 3.5p. But if you look over the medium to long term, with inflation, compounding is your enemy, in the same way that with earning interest or returns on investments, it is your friend. And this gives us a little lesson in inflation, really, because although it doesn't sound like much, at 2.5% inflation, today's 80p bag of crisps will cost £1.32 in 20 years' time. That is only 13p more than they'd cost with 2% inflation. But you've lost a tenth of a bag of crisps. There you go. That's how inflation erodes your purchasing power. And there's an easy way to work this out. It's called the rule of 72. It's a rule of thumb. It's not entirely accurate. Apparently using the number 70 is more accurate, but there's more numbers that divide into 72 than 70. Divide 72 by the rate of inflation, and that will give you roughly the number of years it will take for the cost of something to double, or alternatively, you can look at it as the spending ability of your pound to halve. So with 2% inflation, it's 36 years. With 4% inflation, it's 18 years. And with 6% inflation, it will only take 12 years. And that's not a particularly long time. And that is why people are concerned about higher inflation, even when it doesn't look that much higher. Not 10% inflation, just 4% or 5%, and it's sticking around. It eats into your savings. And the problem is, once upon a time, your savings would probably have been earning an interest rate that was broadly level with inflation or beating it. But now your savings are probably sitting in a legacy account earning 0.01%, unless you are the kind of person who does something about it. So you want to be the kind of person who does something about it. Now, the best easy access account pays 0.5%, which sounds pretty rubbish, but it's better than earning nothing, and it will drag the inflation effect on your money down to 2% from 2.5%. It'll take it back down to the target. Yeah. The best five-year fix is 1.6%. I don't think I'd fix my money for 5 years for that kind of rate, but you could maybe fix for a year or something, or you can consider investing. Don't have to invest all your money, maybe just a little bit of it. Good income investment trust, a global fund or trust, one of the cautious investment trusts or funds that try to just beat inflation plus a bit. But any of that stuff is better than just letting inflation nibble away at your money.
So be that as it may, the same people are concerned about it. All we can do is what we can do to protect our money. What can the powers that be, the Bank of England, say? Because they seem to be able to do some stuff that might change this. What will they be thinking right now?
we're not going to raise interest rates, I think is what they're generally thinking most of the time. That is the most obvious tool in the box for doing it, but maybe interest rates are going to have to go up slightly quicker than people think. And that's why we've seen this sort of tantrum in the markets earlier this year, particularly driven by the US and the Federal Reserve there, because everybody knows that interest rates are going to go up eventually. It's just they think eventually is a long time in the future. And as long as the cheap money keeps flowing, they're therefore, they've got a set of stuff that they are willing to invest in. And if they think interest rates are going to go up sooner than the initial eventually that they thought, that box of stuff that they're willing to invest in changes slightly and might be this other box over here, or it might be a box somewhere in the middle that has a little bit of that stuff in it and a little bit of this stuff in it. And they start selling the stuff that they've got, trying to get ahead of the market, trying to get ahead of everybody else selling, which causes the volatility that we've seen in the stock market. And that's died off a bit, actually, to be honest. And people have gone back to the, this probably isn't so much of a problem, even though we actually had some fresh figures out this week indicating that maybe it is a problem. What it will be is it will increase volatility. I mean, people get over it. They go, okay, all right, well, I can handle eventually being a bit closer than, you know, I originally thought it was. It's if rates suddenly actually do start moving up and start moving up much quicker that you'll get the real kind of panic, as people suddenly go, whoa, that box of stuff there, sell it all now.
Yeah.
And buy that other stuff.
What's your instinct? How long is this going to go on for?
I think inflation will probably stick around for a bit more than central banks think, but not as much as people panicking about inflation think this time around. I think the real risk, and one that has been highlighted before, that we have featured articles on from experts going back over a year ago, is that because central banks don't get enough of a handle on inflation now, it will subside, but then it will come back even stronger tail end of the decade. And then that might be when we have the problem.
All right then, Simon. Right, Grace is back on the case, investigating issues for This Is Money readers, as you do every week. Today, a subject close to my heart, or perhaps my wallet, probably more accurate. I don't think the Dartford crossing can be close to anyone's heart, really. I mean, it's all right when you go over the top. But anyway, a terrible case, this is, of how just missing a few payments can spiral completely out of control, so much so the bailiffs are coming round. Grace, I thought the payment system with Dartford Crossing was automated. My emails tell me whenever I've used the Dartford Crossing. Tell us about the situation and how your reader got into the trouble that they're in.
Okay, so a reader got in touch with me and said he was facing thousands of pounds of debt for missing several Dartford Crossing payments, which are £2.50 either way. It turns out there were actually 54 missing payments, which is a bit more than a couple. However, it still only added up to £135 compared to the £3,100 he was being chased for by the Marsden Group, which are the Highways England debt collectors. He basically was paying for the Dartford Crossing by using a top-up system online. You can put a set amount of money on your account, and he was putting £10 each time, so £2.50 either way, so that's 2 days travel to work and back. He said he'd forgotten to top up the system several times for various reasons, and as such he ended up in quite a bit of debt. As you said, it's not so much automated, the payments. They've got rid of the payment barriers now, which is, I believe, where a lot of the confusion comes from for drivers. So rather than pulling up someone physically taking some cash off you, you have to go online. You can pay prior to crossing the bridge. You can actually pay up to a year in advance for some reason. I mean, if you know you're going to travel a year in advance of the Dartford Crossing, I guess you could. Or up until midnight the day after you can pay off. I think a common problem is that people cross, think, oh, I'll pay after, I won't forget. And then as soon as they're over, of course, they forget.
If you don't do it regularly, I can see that will be a problem. I just have it so it's linked to my bank account, and when it falls below £10, it will automatically top it up or some such thing like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, for some people who don't want it automatically taken out of the bank account, for whatever reason, some people aren't keen on that and choose to top up as they go, then it can be a problem, as such with this reader. So as I say, he was, by the last time he got in touch with me, the debts were up to £3,180 for £135 worth of mispayments, which is over a 2,000% increase in charges.
It's 250, so 135 is quite a lot, though, isn't it?
I mean, a lot of times going over. It's not a lot of money. Yes. It's a lot of times going over where you've missed the thing. And this is no justification for a £3,000 bill. But what I'm trying to work out, someone help me with the maths, because I can't work out what the maths would be on this one. But that's at least, I don't know, what?
54
times. Wow.
54 times, yeah. And I think one of the reader's main sort of concerns with this, and it's something I actually agree with, is that he, you know, would receive emails when he topped up his account to say you have topped up X amount. But when he hasn't made the payment, he received no text, no emails, no sort of online communication, which this day and age you really would expect. And although they sent physical letters to his parents' address where he did live on and off, it's not the same as if you receive a text. It's something you can act on quickly. You can act on your phone, on your online banking while you're there and sort it out. So I do understand his gripe with that. And he had actually paid the debt collectors £640 after they clamped his car, which he says is when he was first made aware of the severity of the issue. Now, £640 is still four times nearly as much as the £135 he owed. So by that point, he assumed, well, the debt is paid, but then it kept adding on thousands and thousands of pounds. I mean, according to the government website, they can issue £70 fines for those who refuse to pay. And this can go up to 105 after 28 days. But that's nothing compared to thousands of pounds. And it does seem, unfortunately, to be a common problem. We at This Is Money have heard several readers get in touch who have been in the same situation, unfortunately, who have ended up with spiralling debts, unfortunately, due to a few mispayments. Now, as you say, I agree, I think it is everyone's duty, really, to keep on top of these payments, keep on top of their correspondence, and really ensure that they don't end up in a situation like this. However, that being said, the escalation is very quick and it seems very harsh.
Simon?
There's a point worth making here. Mm-hmm. It should be free.
Well, see, I was going to get to that, because isn't the point of this to pay off for the bridge being built? It's a bit like a mobile phone contract. Have we not paid off for the handset yet?
Yeah, and we're still paying for the expensive handset long after we needed to. Yeah, the original agreement when the bridge was built was that the tolling was supposed to stop once it paid for itself, which was almost 15 years ago.
Wow.
And I guess that's okay if you're the kind of person who only very occasionally travels across the bridge, mm-hmm. Or under the tunnel. But if you're the kind of person who has to do that on a daily basis, it's quite expensive. And it doesn't really seem fair. The fact that the M25, in order to be a circle, although actually that bit isn't officially the M25, I don't think. The fact that in order to be a circle, it has to go over and under a river. And then anybody who does that over or under a river bit gets charged extra for using a road that is free mm-hmm. at any other point does seem slightly unfair when said bridge has now been paid for.
Yeah, when you put it that way, any noise about that ever going to change, or what's the justification?
No, I mean, imagine if, right? Okay, let's posit a different scenario here.
Okay.
The decision is made that the provision of the ability to drive around London, okay, is a social good, right? Okay, so you need the bridge or you need the tunnel in order to get around, right? So it's actually good for the economy, good for the country as a whole, because you wouldn't want a road that just started on the north bank of the Thames and went all the way around in a circle and then stopped on the south bank of the Thames. And if you wanted to get to the north bank of the Thames, you'd have to drive all the way back round. Okay. So you decide that actually it's good for the country to have the ability to do this, which is presumably why we have this bridge and tunnel in the first place. But you think, actually, maybe it's a bit unfair just to make the people who need to do that little gap pay, even though they are the one using it more. But maybe that's a bit unfair because we've decided this is good for the country. So what you do instead is you bring in a charge that shifts between junctions every couple of months or every 6 months. So for the 6 months, you do the bridge. And then for the next 6 months, you do the chunk between the next junction, the next 6 months and so on. And it works its way around. So it spreads the cost and everybody pays fairly for the thing that has been decided to be good for the country and the economy as a whole. People would be really angry about that, wouldn't they, if they were still paying for it after the bridge had been paid off? They're just basically suckering in the people who've got no choice but to go over the bridge.
When you put it that way, it does seem a bit unfair if you just happen to live or work or whatever just in that area. And people would suggest perhaps they pay enough in taxes that goes onto the roads. Can that necessarily cover? Who knows, Simon? In conclusion with this one, Grace, the lesson here, I mean, obviously, I completely agree with you. Nothing annoys me more when a company will communicate with you solely online, and then when they actually want some money, it's just, who sends letters? But in terms of yourself, what can you do if you're in that situation?
Well, if you found yourself with mounting debts, with the Dart charge, or really in any debt, actually, the best person to contact is the creditors straight away. So this reader really should have contacted them and set up some sort of payment plan. If you're struggling financially, they won't necessarily just charge you the bulk outright. They will find a way around it so that you can pay in installments. Again, this goes with all different kinds of debt. So yeah, the first thing to do is to contact them. And you can also challenge the payments online if you think that this is unfair, if you don't believe actually these debts are correct, or you think you have paid, or there was some sort of extenuating circumstance, you can go online and appeal it. Again, if you are in debt generally, I think speaking to some debt charities could help you make a plan out of it. If you owe money, making installments. But with the Dart charge specifically, I would say for the people that are planning to use it, and especially those who are using it regularly, maybe ensure that you pay upfront every time. Make a note to yourself to pay before you leave the house, and don't ever leave it until the day after if you think there's any sort of chance that you could forget, because you could end up in a situation like this, and it isn't just a one-off, unfortunately.
Indeed, it's not. Grace, you also, on your article, have a hit and miss the week's naughty and nice list, which I rather like. Right, this week, as every week, you look at some of the companies that have fallen short, shall we say, of expected standards, da, 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 as well as the ones that do well and go the extra mile. So who is a miss for you this week?
This week, as of last week as well, actually, it's Virgin Media, one following on from the other. Indeed, yeah. Both actually about the same thing. This week, it was a reader who had received a cheque from Virgin Media for £54 for a missed, for an overpayment she had made on her account. So when she closed it, they sent her a cheque. That should have been the end of the matter. Unfortunately, they sent it to her in the name she set up her account in, which was her old name. She's now been married 4 years. Her name has changed. She let them know about this straight away, sent off a load of documentation, driving license, marriage certificate, all that sort of thing, to say, this is my name now. I can't bank it. You know, my bank won't accept this check. Please, can you send it? She didn't hear anything. Sent all the information again. They sent her a check again in her the name that was on the account that's not her married name. Again, she can't cash it in. This has been going back and forward for quite some time, and it's been months since she cancelled her contract. So whilst it's only £54, it's her money and she should be able to cash it in as and when. So I contacted Virgin Media and they have confirmed they've sent out a cheque in her married name so she can cash it. But this follows on again from last week in my miss. It was also Virgin Media sending out claiming to have sent out a cheque to a customer who had overpaid on her account before she cancelled it. However, she hadn't been able to cash it due to the COVID pandemic, and the bank wouldn't accept it as it was 6 months out of date. And Virgin, months on, still hadn't sent her another one. So it seems to be a bit of a recurring problem, unfortunately. Mm. So if anyone else is in that situation, they can feel free to contact me. On happier note, yeah, the hit nice this week is a cat flap company called Shore Flap. Now, I love cats, so this is very exciting. It was a reader, Jessica, who said that, that these cat flaps basically work. They detect your cat's microchip, so not just any old cat can come in. Very clever. She said their cat flap had, you know, broken once or twice, and the firm had always sent out replacement parts for free, quickly, and even a brand new cat flap in one instance, you know, no questions asked, for free, and it was all easily installed, not a problem at all. So she was really happy with that. And yeah, again, if anyone's got any hits they would like to send me, please do, because we love to hear about companies that are doing well, not just those that are not doing so great.
True. I'm struggling to think either way. hit or miss this week. I don't think I've left the house much. Simon, any for you? Hits and misses? Honorary mentions of anyone? You don't have to.
I can't really think of anything this week, in all honesty. I'm trying to remember what I've done this week. It's Friday. Well, what have I done? I've definitely done a lot of stuff.
I don't know what day it is. All right, then. Well, we'll have a think and we'll probably forget about it by next time. But you have a reader question just to finish off. And I imagine this is something that a fair few people have been considering. My husband and I are coming up to retirement age. Due to decades of house prices rising, our home is worth just over £1 million. However, those price rises also mean that their daughter has struggled to buy a house. We want to downsize, but instead of selling our family home, we'd prefer to gift it to our daughter while converting part of it and the garage into a separate annex that we would live in. Now, their assets, when all combined, would push it over the inheritance tax threshold, probably by some distance. So they want to know if they could simply gift their home to their daughter while continuing to live in part of the house, and what are the tax implications that they should be aware of, Simon? A familiar problem to many, I imagine.
Yes, although not everybody goes to the extent of deciding to live in an annex. But it's
no,
not
more
a bad,
you can't afford to live where you grew up, I think.
No, that is definitely a problem for a lot of people. The annex thing is quite a good idea, actually. And the answer is yes, you can gift your home to your daughter. And the answer to the second part of the question is yes, of course, there are tax implications. So let's have a look at this. Right. If you give your home to your daughter, so say you that's it, you've only got one child, right? Only child, you give the home to them. If you continue to live there, then there are certain implications. If you just give it to them and then you move out and you go live somewhere else and you have nothing to do with that house anymore apart from coming around to visit and hopefully be cooked some rather excellent meals for giving your home away to your child, then as long as you survive for 7 years, there will be no inheritance tax to pay. It tapers down after 3 years. Inheritance tax is basically levied on everybody above a certain value of their estate, the nil rate band, £325,000 per individual. If you're a married couple or civil partners, you can pass on any of your unused nil rate band to your spouse to then be used on their death, which is what a lot of people who would be caught in the net do. There's an extra bit, the own home bit, the main residence nil rate band, which if you pass your home to a direct descendant and your estate is above that original inheritance tax threshold, enables you to pass on a bit more. This was gradually brought in and is now in full existence and effectively means that a married couple with a house that is worth at least £350,000 could pass on up to £1 million tax-free. There is a scenario where for most people that's more money and wealth than they will ever have in their life. And there's an alternative scenario where for a big chunk of people who live in quite a lot of the southeast of England in not particularly flash houses, their house plus a lifetime of savings that they have built up will take them over that limit. So going back to, can you give your house away? Yes, you can give your house away. Any gift that you give, as long as you survive for 7 years, that is exempt from the tax. If you don't survive for 7 years, as I said, there's a taper after three. The crucial difference here is they're going to continue to live in the property. Now, there's obviously a reason why you're not allowed to just give your property to your child and then continue to live in it and they don't even live in it at all, because that would just be tax dodging. That'd be saying, oh no, I've given it to them. It's like, have you really given it to them? Because you're still living there. If you continue to live with them and you just shared the house, then you would have to decide what portion of the house you have given to them, and it would have to be divvied up. 50-50 would maybe be considered fair if there was like an even, you were sharing it evenly. If you were living in an annex, then you could argue that you've given them much more of the house. For example, you could perhaps argue that you've given them 70% of the house and you've retained 30%. If you were to just continue living in the house and give it to them and they didn't live there, you'd have to pay them market rent, a market rate rent, and do all the bills and all that kind of stuff in order to avoid the tax man saying you're just trying to avoid tax and pretending to give them your house. So you actually have to be forking out. If you live in the house with them, then you can probably get away with not paying the market rent, but you can only say you've given them 50% of it. If you're living in the annex, then you could probably say you've given them 70% and you've kept 30% or 80 and 20, however you want to work it. The thing I would say is, if anybody is thinking of doing this, you need to speak to a decent financial advisor or accountant who knows what they are talking about, because there is the risk that it will blow up. And it's not just inheritance tax. There is the potential that you might be seen to be deliberately dodging care fees, and there's an issue there. And there's also the issue where, say, for example, you give your home to your daughter, but your daughter's married, and then your daughter and her husband split up, and it gets acrimonious, and then the husband goes after half the house, and he can't have half the house without the house being sold. All of a sudden, you find yourself having to move out of your annex because they can't sell the house with you living in the annex. So there are all kinds of implications that mean that you need to speak to a specialist financial advisor or accountant who knows what they're talking about. But it's a nice idea, and we're seeing more and more of these stories about people living in houses, and maybe they give their big family house to their child, and then they build one down the end of the garden, or they build an annex, or the other way around. There's a couple of stories about people building little annexes or things for their kids to live in down the bottom of the garden during the pandemic. I think it all boils down to the fact that houses are too expensive, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, also, things like childcare are very expensive. My mum was looking at doing that. She would have moved into a little annex or a flat or whatever, and my sister and her family would have moved in. You know, she gets, I suppose, the company and looked after in older age, and the kids have grandma around and the parents can go to work. So I think that's also an issue.
I think if you can do it and you can manage it so that you do have separate space and you do have your own independent living when you want it, rather than living in the same house together, which would be more of a challenge, then I think it's a great idea. And it can combat loneliness, and it can combat, you know, childcare help. It can help with bills. It can do all these other things. And, you know, maybe we need to see more multi-generational living in this country. Or the other thing is, you know, you could buy, if you could get two semi-detached houses next door to each other, you could buy those together, and then you could take down the fence and you could have a massive garden.
Aww. There you go.
Or you could move into one with your parents next door. You could take down the fence and steal their garden, and you have a massive garden, and they don't have one at all. And you put a gate in that you lock when you don't want them coming into the garden.
Oh, Simon, that's not the spirit. We were going to be such a family-friendly show there. Anyway, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions to the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. You come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. And if you got this far, you can come and leave a comment telling me why I am absolutely completely wrong. And it's the older generation that holds the whip hand here. And it'll be the younger generation that loses their garden and gets a special gate that doesn't allow them in.
If you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.